usually we, you know, we think about a soil test-based interpretation or management decision for phosphorus and potassium. We think more annual investments in sensing to evaluate nitrogen demand or soil supply. But where they interact is really a fun place to be. So it's been a lot of fun to kind of bring those, I would say, different realms together and tie them into really what the farmer sees as a fertilizer bill.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio. Revenue grew, so did your hours. The owner's box, buy back 20 a week. Stop hiring for problems automation can solve. Start with Elevate Agents. Don't hire another VA stuck in 2015. Hire a remote AI specialist from Latin who runs AI tools, works in your time zone, and helps your team move faster. Schedule your free strategy call at www.wisevas.io. Zentrix OS, the business operating system built for teams who are serious about goals, tasks, and measurable results. One platform to run your entire operation. Zentrix Insights. The right person in the right seat starts with knowing how your team is actually wired. Visit ZentrixInsights.com.
So welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show brought to you by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Mark Licht, Associate Professor and Extension Cropping Systems Specialist at Iowa State University. Please subscribe to our channel to receive notifications of new episodes. Today, I get to welcome to the show Dr. John Jones from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign to do a deep dive into the challenges and opportunities when developing state soil test recommendations for phosphorus and potassium. John is an assistant professor of agronomy and soil fertility extension specialist. He received his BS in agronomy from Kansas State University and his MS and PhD from Iowa State University. Go Cyclones. And he also, with his PhD, also has a sustainable ag degree there. Prior to the University of Illinois, John had a soil fertility research program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So welcome, John.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it. I always like seeing some of the cyclone and gold colors across the screen from me.
Yeah, it's a fun opportunity. So maybe why don't we start with this podcast and just have you talk a little bit about who you trained under and some of the work that you did in research for your degrees.
Sure. So I grew up on a small farm north of Madison, Wisconsin. Was involved in ag fairly early and consistently. I had the opportunity when I did my undergrad at Kansas State. I really enjoyed taking courses and learning from Dr. Nathan Nelson there. He had kind of an applied fertility and phosphorus management program. But I would say I really cut my teeth in research and extension, and I would say training to be an investigator more under at Iowa State under Dr. Antonio Mallarino. I did my master's and PhD with him, working on anything from liming calibration and incubation work for recommendations up to phosphorus soil test calibrations for agronomic, but also water quality purposes. So we always like to say we kind of have one foot in the field and one in the stream. And that was kind of the framework of my grad program for my doctorate, was really doing phosphorus work, looking at phosphorus cycling for water quality and agronomic benefits. After Iowa State, I had the opportunity to work up in Wisconsin for a little while, doing a lot of soil test calibration work, and was able to work with Dr. Carrie Lebosky up there for a little while while she was still at UW-Madison, and really got involved with, I would say, more diverse cropping systems, forage crops, really dove into working on nitrogen management challenges for some crops as well. And now I have the opportunity to apply that here in my faculty position at University of Illinois. Here in terms of mentorship, I work a lot with Dr. Emerson Nafsinger, who's been on the podcast before and is around. It was kind of an interesting Illinois-Iowa connection because Dr. John Sawyer was on both of my committees, and he had a large presence in Illinois before moving to Iowa. So we're all a tight-knit community, I think, in the North Central region.
Yeah, you've got some really good mentors between Emerson and John, and then Antonio, obviously, and yeah, Carrie Laboski as well, right? So you've got some really good experiences there. And you're a soil fertility specialist that's got a lot of work in not only a lot of times we see them where you have a lot of experience in nitrogen or a lot of experience in phosphorus and potassium, but you've got kind of a blend of all three.
Yeah, it's really been fun to kind of bring what you learn to look at other nutrients. You know, and it was very common in graduate school. You have your nutrient of focus. I was the P person in our lab when I was initially working on things. What was fun is to take that to some of the projects I had in Wisconsin and bringing down here to Illinois as well, is really look at what it allowed me to do is look at nutrient interactions in a different way. So usually we think about a soil test based interpretation or management decision for phosphorus and potassium. We think more annual investments and sensing to evaluate nitrogen demand or soil supply, but where they interact is really a fun place to be. So it's been a lot of fun to kind of bring those, I would say, different realms together and tie them into really what the farmer sees as a fertilizer bill.
Yeah. So let's jump into talking about phosphorus and potassium recommendations, but maybe let's start about, you know, what does that process look like, you know, for P and K versus or compared to nitrogen recommendations?
So the foundational concepts of phosphorus and potassium, I'll say behavior in soils and plants, is what defines how we create guidelines that we hope are useful for farmers and agronomists. And so within that, because they're more immobile nutrients, I won't say completely immobile because we can track K movement quite a long distance in some soils and P to some extent. But in general, we treat them as more immobile nutrients that are going to be there for at least a few years to a few decades or centuries after we apply them. And so because of that, we can use soil testing as a basis or an index for availability and fertilization decisions. One of the things that comes up a lot in textbook conversations or introductory soil fertility discussions are the two processes of correlation and calibration. Correlation is simply the relationship between a soil test value and a crop yield response to fertilization. That's kind of one of the pieces that gets missed. A lot of times they say, oh, it's a correlation to crop yield, but it's not really. We want to know how that crop responds to fertilization. For the calibration side, it's really just understanding what rate we need to apply for a given soil test level. Now, those are two common kind of pillars of determining a phosphorus potassium recommendation. They require a lot of field research, lab research, a lot of integration between what we see, I'll say, biophysically in the field and the crop response, but then also what's a farmer going to do when they apply phosphorus to potassium? Are there application logistics to apply it every 2 years? Do they have a growing season or yield potential area that they're working in that they can afford to build up soil test levels, or is it more of an annual ROI based decision making process? Those are kind of some of the concepts that I think about a lot when looking at phosphorus and potassium. Phosphorus certainly has also water quality implications, and so when we think about best agronomic practices, we really like to tie those into how do we reduce losses the most. Potassium, we don't necessarily have a water quality concern, but certainly it's a nutrient that's really challenging. I would say potassium is the nutrient that gives me the most headaches when trying to interpret soil test values across different soils, cropping systems, and things like that.
I guess, what does that mean for farmers and agronomists? I mean, they're really managing their phosphorus and potassium quite a bit differently than they maybe manage some of their nitrogen recommendations.
Yeah, one of the things to think about, and maybe I'll go back to the soil test part for a second there, is when we think about what a soil test value represents, that really determines how we should talk about this process within nutrient management. A soil test value or a single value for your grid, your zone, your research plot, that has to represent an entire crop year of uptake. And so it's an index. And usually we talk about it in parts per million. In Illinois, we still use pounds per acre, but that's kind of a conversion we have to get across state borders. But essentially, it's an index of availability. It's not necessarily specifically tied to the amount of nutrient that a plant sees throughout the growing season. And so because of that, we need a few things. We need it to be really reproducible in terms of when we have that use that test to assess fertility recommendations or to fertilization decisions in multiple soils and crops.
Oh,
so essentially when we think about what a soil test value represents, it really comes down to representing a whole year's worth of crop nutrient uptake and use. And so when we think about that, we really have to have two things. We need a really strong statistical backing or just numerical relationship between that soil test value and crop response. And it needs to be reproducible wherever that recommendation is going to be taking place. That also means that the underlying research is important. And where that's done, that has to reflect where the interpretation and recommendations are going to be used as well. So similar soils, cropping systems, even climate conditions as well. What does this mean for a farmer? Well, it means when you're looking at a soil test booklet or maybe your report that comes back with your soil test results, the recommendations and guidelines really need to be representing your specific system. And that's an opportunity to reach out and work with. Maybe it's your extension specialist. Maybe it's your agronomist at your ag retailer that worked on those guidelines. But really understanding what's the basis and history of how those numbers came to be. Sometimes that's kind of a black box in certain regions where maybe there hadn't been a history of research for a while or for a few decades. But it's really important to really refine that and define those methods that led to those numbers. And that's, I think, what we're really starting to see, I would say, around the country in the North Central region as well, though. When we have some kind of newer faculty and extension specialists moving in, we're looking at really defining those in a transparent way. And so we know from the farm level how we got those numbers as well. Where I think we're in a different situation maybe than we were 20 or 30 years ago is we have the ability to capture so much data from on-farm activities, whether that's from your planter passes, your tillage passes, or from the combine. And so within that, we can do a lot of on-farm experimentation that can lead to farm and field-specific information that takes the science from recommendations and brings that into a given farming operation. And so one of the things that's important, we talk about maybe a PDF of recommendations that exists somewhere on the website. Well, maybe our next goal, and this is what we're trying to work on in some of our projects here, is make that in a format that a grower can adjust or essentially kind of take that value, that one book value, and alter that based off of some on-farm research results, and then plug that into whatever site-specific ag program or platform they have. That's really important. And so I think when we think about farmer relevant information regarding soil test phosphorus and potassium recommendations, they really need to be in an actionable form. Can we be able to identify field specific removal values or grain removal? And then that's the basis for fertilization, depending on your system. We've got agronomists that are already doing that. So it's really fun to see that those advancements and then work with them in the field directly.
That's interesting. There's a large effort to be able to kind of make these recommendations, but also utilize those farmer fields, right? You know, farmers are one of the best citizen scientists there are out there, right? I mean, they can collect a tremendous amount of data and pull it all together. So that's a fun opportunity to be able to take advantage of now. So with the phosphorus and potassium, there's a number of different methods out there, right? I mean, on the phosphorus side, we have Bray P1 and P2 sometimes you see, as well as Malic 3 and Olson. Whereas for potassium, you know, we see the Malic 3 ICP and the ammonium acetate methods. These aren't created equal, are they? And how do we use these, and are some better than others?
Yeah, so a lot of these soil tests, you'll notice a lot of them are named after the scientists who at least published them. A quick history fact, if there's any trivia buffs out there, Adolf Malik did his PhD at UW-Madison. I've actually physically read his PhD dissertation. Soil test he was working on for potassium in Wisconsin was actually using bacterial or fungal growth. When you extracted nutrients from a soil and essentially in a petri dish, you grew a bacteria, and then what he associated that nutrient level to was the increase in bacterial growth. That was their soil assay or soil test. Then he moved to North Carolina and started working with more, I will say, intensive wet chemistry, and we got the Mehlich 3 test eventually. That's just kind of a story, but the basis for a lot of these soil tests was really just getting to a point where they don't really mimic, I will say, comprehensively what we're seeing in the, let's say, the rhizosphere around the plant root. And the reason they don't necessarily mimic that is because they were really made to have a strong statistical or empirical relationship with crop response. They're really essentially they're a proxy for nutrient availability. And that's probably why a lot of times when we look at all these different tests, they have fairly contrasting chemistry or active mechanisms that pull nutrients out of the soil or bombard nutrients in the soil solution so that we can measure them. The reason they're not necessarily created equal was because they were usually developed in different regions of the country or let's say the North Central region even to work on specific soils in specific regions. So for example, we talked about the Mehlich 3 test was really developed initially to work in the southeast part of the United States. It was adjusted over a few different revisions to get to a point where it could work in both acidic and alkaline soils. The Olson test, or the bicarbonate extractable nutrient test for phosphorus, is really developed to work on calcareous soils and moving west. Now, Iowa is a good example. All those tests are calibrated for recommendations in the state because you find different soils that kind of match what those tests were designed to do, right? And so that's certainly something where when we think about developing recommendations, we need to think about, as an extension specialist, what are our clientele using? What could they potentially be using across the state? And let's do the research to provide recommendations for all of them, at least the ones that make sense to be using. And that's something I feel really strongly about because we're going out and we're doing a lot of field research. We're taking thousands of soil samples a year. Measuring a few more tests on them is not a big step to get to the point where we have a lot of data that's very usable for growers and agronomists out there. So it's kind of wrapping around the differences in soil test methods. When we start to get into specifics, essentially, usually you're looking at a different amount of nutrient extracted. And it's because of the way the wet chemistry work interacts with the given soil. You'll see differences. For example, a Bray test, because it's determined a certain way and the phosphorus is extracted a certain way, it usually measures less than a Mehlich 3 ICP test. There's a lot of, I will say, muddiness in what specific form of P is measured in the Mehlich 3 ICP compared to the Bray. But essentially, the most important thing is, whatever recommendation you're using, make sure that the underlying research used the exact test you're running on your soil sample. That will ensure the most accuracy and avoid unwanted error. And we know error exists in this process, from soil sampling to lab analysis to interpretation. We have error throughout the whole process. We can minimize that by making sure that the research represents where we need to use those numbers.
We often see soil tests come back in and depending on the test lab and who's doing it, you know, we may see Olsons, we may see Brays, we may see Mehlichs here in Iowa. And so it's a lot of times we have to take a step back and ask, you know, what analysis method is being used, because that gives you completely different ways in interpreting and making recommendations off of it. So that's a really good point that you've made there.
I'll add one more point is that if you're in a state and you're working with a lab that offers multiple methods, usually it doesn't break the bank too much to run one or two different methods on your samples. But that's kind of a good back check. Look at the ratios between those tests. If your lab's always running a Bray and a Mehlich, look at the ratios between those tests over time for a given field, and you can probably see something was off with this sample, or this looks pretty consistent over time. That's a really good opportunity to kind of have a quality assurance system built into your soil test reporting program.
So you're working in this space now, and you've been, you know, working at it a little bit between the two states. So what are you starting to see in some of your, you know, early findings?
Yeah, Yeah, so I think one of the things that's popping up fairly easily when we look at, we'll say, refining or updating recommendations is that we do see some shifts in, I'll call them soil test interpretation classes, or how what a given soil test value means. And I saw this in Wisconsin. I know Antonio saw it in Iowa. I think Dr. Dan Kaiser is seeing it in Minnesota, or seeing shifts, we'll say, to the right, or to interpretation classes that are moving up a little bit. What I think that represents is the fact that, and this is kind of an interesting concept, is that no matter if you're working on a build or a sufficiency program, we're obtaining higher yields across the board, which means we remove more nutrients across the board. There's a discussion of a nutrient concentration within the grain, and is that decreasing as we get to higher yields? But we know that as we remove more grain from a given field, we remove more nutrients. If we're wanting to maintain soil test levels, we need to apply at least those back. But really what we're asking our soils to do is operate at a higher RPM and cycle nutrients efficiently and in larger, I'll say larger masses or larger volumes. So before, if we were maybe only removing 25 pounds of pea with a, we'll say, profitable corn crop, really that's not cycling a whole lot of phosphorus through to replace that. And maybe back in those days, manure was available as well locally. Now, if we're removing 30, 40 to 50 pounds of phosphorus with a high-yielding corn crop per acre, we're expecting our applied pea to be 100% efficient at returning that available pea into that system. So essentially, we've increased the we'll say, arrows in a nutrient cycle. We've made those arrows much thicker because we're removing more and we're having to keep up when we fertilize. That's something that I think is being present in a lot of these updates to soil test interpretations around the North Central region, at least. And so because of that, we're kind of wanting to make sure that, well, we really harp on monitoring soil testing every 2 years if you can. I know we always joked working in Iowa that I think the elevation of the state lessened because of the amount of soil tests that were taken, soil samples. We'll try to do that in Illinois too. But essentially, the value of knowing what's in your soil is greater because there's such a potential to either drop low or save money by not having to apply. One of the things that I've been incorporating into my research, and that's in the background of most soil test recommendations, and the terminology varies, but it's a buffering capacity of nutrients. And essentially it's meaning that really means in I will say layman's terms, that what's the pound of P2O5 or K2O to increase your soil test one part per million? But also, what's the removal of that same P2O5 or K2O to decrease one parts per million? Every recommendation system assumes they're the same, going up and going down. And usually we only have maybe one book value. Iowa communicates a range. There's some ranges in Wisconsin that we communicated as well. But essentially what that means is that our soils are responding to fertilization and removal in the same way. And actually, some of the research that we've been doing in our group has said that that's probably not true. And really, it matches what farmers complain about. I can't build soil test K levels. Well, we've seen that actually the kinetics of buildup and drawdown are different for K. For phosphorus, especially in areas with historical manure, high manure applications, I can't draw down my P levels to what the P index says I should be at. Well, we're actually seeing in the kinetics, it's easier to build up soil test P than draw it down. And so when we think about though, you know, what we hear from the farm gate, or you know, what a given person may complain about relative to their soil testing program, is kind of matching what we're seeing in some of the, I'll say, more basic nutrient research and more applied soil chemistry. That has importance though, all the way back to what you pay for your fertilizer bill. Because if you're trying to build soil tests, is it a realistic goal that you can build to a certain level for potassium, for example? So I think those kind of nutrient kinetics and how they relate to soil test interpretations, fertilization responses, is something that I've been working on quite a bit.
Okay, John, we're getting rapidly coming to the end of our time here. So before we dive into our final three questions, for the listeners, remember to like, subscribe, or share the Crop Science Podcast show presented by Wisenetics. You can also set the notifications on your channel so that way you don't miss these upcoming episodes. And then please feel free to leave us comments at any time. We truly appreciate those.
It's time for our famous three.
Wisenetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access wisenetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence, starting now.
Okay, so ready for the final three questions. John, what is your go-to agronomy resource?
Well, I know Farmer and Ag Twitter is always kind of fun to see what everyone's talking about, whether you're active on that or not. I would say actually one of the things that I really like, and this is maybe a little old school, but I really like being able to go meet at coffee shops around the state with a lot of agronomists. I do that probably once a week. And I think, you know, if your state has a crop reporting program, that's usually where I start to look for problems that are coming out in the field. As far as agronomy resource of information, I think there's a suite of podcasts out there that you can, you know, subscribe to certainly. And see what's going on. But I think there's a few options. I'm probably a little more old school. I read a lot of academic journals, but that's just the name of the game for the position I'm in.
What resources outside of agriculture would you recommend to any of our listeners?
What resources outside of agriculture? I would say if you are interested in numbers at all, there's a great podcast called Quantitude. That it's run by some statisticians in North Carolina and Maryland, and they relate anything from wacky trivia to what's going on in your stats analysis of given research. They're medical researchers, but I listen to that podcast probably on a weekly basis.
I will have to write that one down and look it up. I tend to like to listen to some podcasts, especially on the weekends when things slow down a little bit.
And it's actually nothing. It won't be ag related at all. But it's fun to see what comes to mind when you hear this random conversation.
And then the last question here, in your opinion, what sets successful professionals kind of above the rest?
So along that same line, I think one of the things that especially we do in soil fertility, I think already, is really pay attention to how others are innovating in other spaces and other industries. There's a lot to learn. I'll give one example. We had a program up at UW-Madison where they paid for a random lunch for three people from across campus, and you would meet and talk. I started talking with someone who is studying essentially cancer cells in the brain, and they were talking about kriging between points and images. And I said, well, we use kriging in soil spatial analysis. It was a fantastic conversation. So I would really kind of just branch out, think about where innovation happens in other spaces. Certainly in the realm of AI and machine learning, it's probably easier to do that now than it ever has been. But taking a step back, you know, take your agronomist hat off for a second, look at kind of what's happening around you, then you can put it back on and apply to something you're doing in the field, maybe.
Yeah, I think that is probably happening more and more just as we think about collaborations and making looking at these innovative, you know, type of structures, new technologies and things, right? And I think we see that in agriculture now, where we are working with mechanical engineers, computer engineers. This automation and AI and machine learning is really, you know, really forcing agriculture to kind of do that anyhow.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, if we can simplify and automate processes that let us kind of, I'll say, dream about new things or daydream about a new potential in science or even just how you run your farm operation. I saw on social media the other day, a friend of mine who farms had a robot mowing his yard, and now he doesn't have to mow his laneway anymore. It has more time to work in the shop or do other things. There's certainly ways we can allow ourselves to have a little more time and space to innovate.
That concludes another episode of the Crop Science Podcast Show presented by Wisenetics. Dr. John Jones, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. Your feedback is invaluable to us. Until next time, this is Mark Licht with the Crop Science Podcast Show.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.